Cryptocurrency, very simply, is digital money. It sounds very esoteric. It sounds very dark web, and it has a lot of controversy surrounding it. But when you boil it down, all it really is an online ledger.
Paul Vigna covers cryptocurrency for the Wall Street Journal.
The difference is that there is no government backing it. There is no government maintaining the ledger. The ledger is maintained automatically on the network of computers.
The leading cryptocurrency is Bitcoin.
There's no way to ignore the fact that Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are a response to what were the perceived flaws of the existing financial system. And it is no coincidence that when Bitcoin was unveiled, the global economic system was in the middle of the largest crisis of our lifetimes and probably of the last 100 years. 50 years ago, you had no choice but to trust governments. You had no choice but to trust banks. You had no choice but to trust third parties. You are now building systems where you do not need to trust those third parties. That is going to be a significant friction in the years ahead.
This is the future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal.
From the newsroom in New York, I'm Jennifer Strong, and this is the future of everything. The story begins on the heels of the global financial crisis in 2008, when a mysterious internet presence appeared with a white paper under the name Satoshi Nakamoto.
Who is, can you say his name?
Satoshi Nakamoto.
Satoshi Nakamoto?
Satoshi
Nakamoto. Satoshi Nakamoto.
Who the is Satoshi Nakamoto?
Wait, what's her name again? Satoshi Yakamoto? Not one more time.
Well, Satoshi Nakamoto, that's a name I love to say. And we don't know much about him, but he came to save the day. When he wrote about the way things are and the way things ought to be, he gave us all a protocol this world had never seen. Oh, Bitcoin, as you're going into the old blockchain. Oh, Bitcoin, I know you're going to rain, till everybody knows, till everybody knows your name.
And for the first time, you had somebody, we don't know who that person is yet, you had somebody coming out and saying, look, this system is flawed. This system has problems. It is impossible to miss them because it's burning the entire global economy to the ground right now. Here is another possible way that we could do this. And that message hit at a time when people were very, very open to hearing it. And I think a lot of Bitcoin's success comes from that, because other people had proposed this earlier. Bitcoin was not the first attempt to build a digital monetary system. It was the first one to succeed.
Among the first to publicly experiment with Bitcoin was Fidelity Investments, one of the world's largest money management firms.
We're here in Boston at Fidelity Labs headquarters, and we're actually in a space that we affectionately call the egg, because it kind of looks like the inside of an egg, if you can imagine that.
Hadley Stern runs the incubator behind these experiments.
The way that I would suggest you think about Bitcoin is like Napster. When Napster came out, it was a breakthrough. For the first time, music was digitized.
People no longer had to go to a store to buy an object with music on it.
Napster had some legality issues and some societal questions, much like Bitcoin does. And about 10 years later, things changed.
He shows me a device that's used to make Bitcoin.
So this little mining thing that we're seeing in front of us, it's an ant miner. What's fascinating about this, when Bitcoin started, people could mine on their computers. As time goes on, much like in gold, mining gets harder and harder.
Mining is how Bitcoin is created, but what is mining in the Bitcoin world?
Mining is basically a competition to solve a very complicated mathematical puzzle. And the person who solves it first wins the block.
Now, to be clear, most people at this point buy Bitcoin rather than try to mine it, like gold. Stern says people often confuse Bitcoin with payment platforms such as PayPal or Venmo.
Newsflash, those things are not digital. They are companies that use human-based systems to validate transactions and put a digital layer on top of them.
Bitcoin is not a company. It's an open-source network that runs all by itself, day in, day out, validating transactions. But as with other autonomous technologies, it raises fundamental questions about the notion of trust.
so what that we can validate transactions through software and software alone? That may actually not be enough. A lot of what we do as a society is still very human-based, that even though there are these technology innovations, there's kind of a so what or a should we kind of question.
Because on the surface, we live in a very digital world.
Yet, if I wanted to buy a car from you, at the end of the day, you and I are going down to the Department of Motor Vehicles together to get our car title exchanged as a piece of paper. So even though we have very digital lives, when it comes to the really important stuff, money, stocks, proof of ownership, it still comes down to paper.
As the transfer of value becomes digital, it's not just going to be about Bitcoin or the thousands of other cryptocurrencies currently out there. And there's disagreement, so much disagreement, even about what to call it. The IRS does not treat digital currency as money, but as property. Even people who pay their bills with it often refer to Bitcoin as software. Perhaps the only thing everyone agrees on is what makes cryptocurrency work, a technology called blockchain.
Essentially, what blockchain comprises is a network of linked computers, none of which are in control, an accounting book, really. So what happens is every transaction on the network goes into the ledger. The ledger is replicated on every single computer. So every single transaction has a record of it on every single computer. What that essentially does is it makes it virtually impossible to counterfeit, alter, or fake the history, the trading history.
But chances are, if you've heard anything about cryptocurrencies, you've heard of their darker underbelly.
There is a lot of emphasis put on the sort of nefarious uses of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. Those things exist and they are real, but those things exist and are real for government-backed currencies. Those things exist and are real for any computer that is used to commit a crime. I don't think that is the best use of Bitcoin, and I actually think criminals are starting to figure this out, because one really unappreciated aspect of Bitcoin, at least early on, was the fact that this record of transactions, it also happens to record every single time you committed a crime. So if the government gets a hold of that ledger of transactions and the government can then link you to those transactions, the government has an extremely compelling case to present in a court of law, which has happened.
Vinya introduces me to Whalepool. Think of it as an open-air, unfiltered squawk box of market action in the cryptosphere.
What's up, lads? How are you doing?
Users log in from all over the world, and they lean heavily male.
I literally had to head out of the low. And when I came back, we're $600 higher. What the f***?
That's crypto for you. Great day to be back.
ATMs are also finding new life in the age of cryptocurrency. At the foot of the Staten Island Ferry in Lower Manhattan, there's a Bitcoin ATM in the back of a pizza shop. If you're curious how this works, a Bitcoin ATM accepts dollars and, in return, adds the Bitcoin equivalent to a customer's digital wallet. At some ATMs, the reverse is also possible. A user can redeem bitcoins for cash. There are more than 100 of these ATMs just in New York City. At this pizza shop, we chat with the cashier behind the counter.
Yeah, a lot of people come, like in the morning, I see a lot of young kids, they come, they use the machine. But I don't know what it is exactly, but yeah.
He says it's been here less than half a year. The Bitcoin ATM now stands where a normal one used to be.
Oh, it has to be cash. Oh, a credit card.
Another customer steps up to the machine, an attorney named Zach Shapiro.
So I found this particular Bitcoin ATM online, and I'm just really interested in the future of cryptocurrency and the potential it has. And my particular interest is in the legal regulatory side, the money laundering stuff.
It's his first time using one of these.
It looks like I didn't get an awesome exchange rate, but if it costs a dollar to figure out how this thing works, I'm willing to do that.
The next ATM customer we meet claims to be an early backer of cryptocurrencies.
My name is Nehemia Kramer. I am one of the first investors in Ethereum.
Like, this is not a novelty to you. This is a regular way to get money, right?
Yeah. Right, because most of the money I get in cryptocurrencies.
Despite the fact he's taking it from an ATM to go buy lunch, he doesn't call it money.
It's absolutely meaningless calculation because it's not a currency. it's just the technology. And if it will be more advanced technology, it will just disappear, but that's the name of the game.
At this Bitcoin ATM, we met people ranging from bank employees to the unbanked. It's not what we expected to find.
No, I was very surprised to see that many people in a short amount of time come here and jump on that, and not all of them doing it for the first time. You know, it's surprising to see people come here and using it not as a novelty, but as a normal ATM, as a normal part of their day.
And that's just it. For some people, it is a novelty. But for others, Bitcoin is becoming a way of life.
My name's Derek J. Freeman. We're in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. This is the Free State Bitcoin Shop. We're a place for gifts, and we only accept Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies.
He's the shop's owner.
People passing through who see the sign and say, wow, Bitcoin in a store? That's a thing now? Sometimes they have a Bitcoin wallet on their phone, and they buy something. If they don't, we help them get set up.
New Hampshire is the live free or die state. There's a growing Bitcoin community, in part because it's not controlled by any government or bank. This shop also has what appears to be an ATM, but Freeman calls it a vending machine.
It dispenses Dash and Litecoin. We prefer that in our store because it has lower transaction fees. So if you're buying something like a keychain, it doesn't make sense to pay a $5 fee on top of a $5 item. But if you use something like Litecoin or Dash, the fee can be 1 or 2 cents.
Some restaurants take it, both here and in the neighboring state of Maine. Even some apartments accept it as a way to pay rent. And reporter Paul Vigna says banks are trying to get in on the action.
How can we tame this? How can we use this so that we can make money off of it rather than it coming in and taking out pieces of our business?
But what does that mean for the early adopters of Bitcoin, the ones trying to get away from big banks?
It's a great irony that the banks have now turned around and said, we think we can make money at Bitcoin, and let's trade futures on Bitcoin, and let's have a trading desk, let's make markets in Bitcoin, and let's treat Bitcoin like oil or corn or coffee or any of those things that we like to trade and make money off of. It is a great irony, and I think probably a lot of the early Bitcoiners are not particularly happy about the banks coming in and trying to kick up the sand in their playground.
Until quite recently, we hadn't heard all that much about banks and Bitcoin.
My name is Emily Glazer. I am a banking reporter based in Los Angeles. In fact, I still remember having a conversation with the banking team, and we were thinking about how neat a story it would be to find out if there are any Bitcoin traders at large banks, and got into a debate about who thought that was possible and who thought that there wasn't any possibility there.
Her colleague, Paul Vigna, hears that Goldman Sachs is weighing a new trading operation dedicated to Bitcoin and other digital currencies. This is huge news. A few weeks before this, J.P. Morgan chief Jamie Dimon was asked whether his bank employed anyone who traded Bitcoin.
His response was that if J.P. Morgan had that, and I quote him here, I'd fire them in a second. It's against our rules, he said, and any trader that deals in cryptocurrencies is, quote, stupid. So as you can imagine, it just sent off sparks.
Then, on the other end of the spectrum, here comes Goldman Sachs.
Now, this story just took off because it's validating cryptocurrencies and Goldman Sachs, like the king of Wall Street in many cases, for them to be weighing this is real.
The journal prints the story, and the very next day, Goldman Sachs chief executive gets on Twitter.
Lloyd Blankfein, who is a relatively new Twitter user, he's got 21 tweets under his belt on October 3rd, the next day after the Wall Street Journal story came out. Still thinking about hashtag Bitcoin, period. No conclusion, not endorsing / rejecting. Know that folks also were skeptical when paper money displaced gold. That 140 characters certainly stirred people up quite a bit.
You can then take a step back and say, well, why do we all use money?
The Wall Street Journal's James McIntosh in London.
Well, at the end of the day, there's a government who employs a bunch of people with guns who tell you you've got to pay taxes in dollars. It's not perfect, but that's one argument for why dollars have value.
But he says there's a much broader question here about why we also use it for everything else.
I use dollars because you use dollars. In fact, actually, I use sterling mostly because I'm in London. But in America, you use dollars and the other person uses dollars and it's convenient. And so you kind of just do. The same could happen for Bitcoin. You could say, well, I use Bitcoin, you use Bitcoin. That's fine. We'll all use Bitcoin.
that's not how he sees this playing out.
In order to get that, it would have to get this network effect. It would have to convince enough people that it really is valuable to be valuable. And it's kind of, well, how do you predict that? Well, it's very hard to do.
He says it happened to gold, but only after thousands of years.
On top of that, if you were buying Bitcoin against a societal collapse, similar to what's going on in Venezuela, shortages and electricity cuts, well, Bitcoin isn't much use if your electricity is being cut off. Frankly, gold is better than Bitcoin because you can bury it in the garden, and if society ever collapses, you can dig it up again and use it. And that makes me think, probably, if it isn't either a currency or digital gold, then it isn't anything apart from an interesting experiment that has provided us with the very useful introduction of blockchain to the world.
At this point, companies in every sector of the economy are experimenting with blockchain. There's even a trade group.
Hello, my name is Perry M. Boring. I'm the founder and president of the Chamber of Digital Commerce.
We met at the Museum of American History in Washington, D.C.
They have an exhibit on money. So it starts with commodities, gold and silver, and other barter instruments. And we follow it around to the gold standard, to fiat monies.
That is, the paper money we take for granted.
And then at the end here is a copy of Bitcoin Magazine and a very, very small segment on cryptocurrencies. So this really is quite an achievement. 3 years ago, when we first opened the doors at the Chamber of Digital Commerce, no one took Bitcoin seriously. There's been a lot of scandals that have hit the industry, from things like Mt. Gox, the exchange in Japan that went under, almost $500 million of consumer funds were gone. So that was a big black eye to the industry. Also the Silk Road incident. So the online marketplace where they were selling illegal drugs with Bitcoin.
She says none of this was helpful to companies trying to use Bitcoin or other blockchain technologies for productive purposes.
We had a senator who called for a ban on Bitcoin. There were multiple agencies, government authorities issuing warnings about the dangers of Bitcoin. So to go from that just 3 years ago to be standing inside a Smithsonian with a copy of Bitcoin Magazine behind a glass wall here is quite an achievement.
Yet, she says it's hard to know what Bitcoin will be when it grows up.
Because it's open source, anyone has the opportunity to innovate with it. And this is something that has captured the imagination of the heads of some of the most powerful people in government, to leading venture capitalists around the world, some of the brightest minds in technology.
One of these bright minds is Jackson Palmer, creator of Dogecoin, a cryptocurrency that started as a joke, but became one of the most powerful. It features a popular meme of a dog.
For those that are unaware, it's a Shiba Inu, a Japanese breed of dog, looking into a camera in a certain funny way that kind of took the internet by storm. And so my brain one afternoon just kind of put the two together, and kind of as a jab at making fun of the cryptocurrency space that I was kind of monitoring at the time, Dogecoin was born, and I tweeted about it.
For Palmer, creating Dogecoin was a reaction against the cryptocurrency community.
There was a high barrier to entry because it was a very technical space. And just like now, it involves a certain amount of money to kind of buy some Bitcoin. So I think Dogecoin, because it took itself a lot less seriously, having a Doge, the Doge meme on front of it, it was more welcoming to a diverse and broader range of people, a wider demographic.
But Palmer is no stranger to internet subcultures, especially since creating his own.
Typically what happens with any subculture or new technology community is they typically eventually get co-opted by people with profit in their mind, right? Like with the dollar signs in their eyes. And this is what we were trying to avoid.
And so what started as a digital currency joke became a space for seriousness.
There started to be scams. There started to be hacks. The community just stopped having that initial good vibe that it had. And I was at the same time trying to protect the community. So I was calling out a lot of these scammers. But surprisingly, as a result, I actually kind of got it shouted out of the community because a lot of people supported these scammers.
You might say Dogecoin died in a battle for control. And this fight is something to date Bitcoin has avoided.
The beauty of Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of Bitcoin, still having that mask, is that there's no one person that controls Bitcoin. And I think that's a good thing, because I think what it means is that the open source software community can pick up that legacy and drive it forward in a truly decentralized, consensus-driven way. It's dangerous for programmable money to have a single point of failure in a single leader.
Satoshi matters and doesn't matter.
Again, the Wall Street Journal's Paul Vigna.
This system has now been in existence for 9 years. You have an entire group of people now who are supporting this and helping to build it and helping to nurture it and move it along. On the other hand, you now have this creation myth. Who is Satoshi Nakamoto? Creation myths are extremely compelling things to us. I mean, we're always curious about where did we come from? Where did this thing come from? What does it mean? What is the purpose of it?
What if the one who could answer these questions comes back?
Satoshi is holding possibly up to 1 million Bitcoin, which are now valued in the billions. So you are now talking about somebody who has an incredible amount of economic leverage on the network. You would then have a person who would immediately have moral authority within Bitcoin circles. You know, it comes down to like, would they believe in God again? Would they let the God of Bitcoin come back and take control of his own project?
It's a question we can't answer. But what we do know,
you are going to see regulators in every country in the world wrap their head and their arms and their minds around this. Central banks are looking at this technology and saying, how can we use this technology to benefit our people the most? And I think that is going to be a very, very compelling dynamic over the next 5-10 years. You're going to see businesses experiment with it more. You're going to see people experiment with it more. You're going to see entrepreneurs trying to build the quote-unquote killer app, the thing that makes Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies so easy for the masses to use that they start adopting it.
And it's not just about the world's entrepreneurs, regulators, and luminaries.
What you have are people trying to think of new ways to structure society and ways to do it directly. And this allows them to do that directly. It becomes a tool for them to help rebuild anything they perceive to be a problem. And that can be an extremely powerful dynamic when it happens.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. The show is produced by Laura Sim and Martha C. Daniel. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Paul Vigna, Emily Glazer, James McIntosh, Larry Root, Jennifer Hicks, and Mike Miller. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong from the newsroom in New York.
Who's Satoshi Nakamoto? Who's Satoshi Nakamoto? All right, there you go.
Thank you, work.
Down the road, it will be told about the death of old Mt. Gox, about traders trading altar coins and miners mining blocks. But them good old boys back in Illinois and on down through Tennessee, see, they don't care to be a millionaire. They're just wanting to be free. Our Bitcoin, as you're going into the old blockchain. Our Bitcoin, I know you're going to rain. Till everybody knows, till everybody knows your name.